from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's forum program, can we rewire the brain to become more compassionate? That's one of the questions central to the work of James Doty, director of Stanford's Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Doty's new book, Into the Magic Shop, chronicles his journey from a chaotic childhood in Southern California to a scientist at the cutting edge of the heart-brain connection. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. We're joined this hour in studio by Stanford neurosurgery professor James Doty, who directs the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research at Stanford. He's also an entrepreneur and a philanthropist, and he's published a memoir called Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. And we welcome Jim Doty to the second forum hour.
It's wonderful to be with you today, Michael.
Great to have you here. And I do want to begin by talking about the magic shop, because that plays a preeminent role, which you went into when you were 12 years old, just sort of looking around for something to do on your fancy new bike. It struck me, in fact, that you had one of those bikes that I longed for as a kid, but nevertheless came out of poverty.
Yes, absolutely. My father was an alcoholic and was only intermittently employed. My mother had a stroke and was partially paralyzed and had a seizure disorder and, frankly, was chronically depressed and had attempted suicide multiple times. We were on public assistance. Neither had gone to college.
Yeah, you came up with and we'll talk about this odyssey of yours, because you came out with a good deal of disadvantages, to put it. It's almost kind of a Ben Carson story in a way, isn't it? It's probably been compared to that, eh?
Well, hopefully that's might be where the comparison might end.
You didn't stab anybody.
No, I haven't stabbed anybody yet. But
plus, African-American guy from the Redlands in the Southern California doesn't necessarily equate. But neurosurgery, you know, I mean, it's like talking about rocket science in many people's judgment when you advance to that level of profession.
No, that's right. I mean, I think many people perceive it as the epitome of success, certainly in regard to the medical field, of course, unless you talk to a heart surgeon who would feel that's the epitome. But certainly becoming a professor of neurosurgery at a major academic institution is what many would consider the pinnacle of success.
We've also just sort of immersed ourselves into one of the major motifs of your book, that is mind versus heart, or mind with heart, and we'll get into that in the course of our discussion here. But let me first talk about what you open with, which is a very delicate and fragile surgery on a young boy, removing a tumor from this young boy. And it's a very engaging account, and you write in ways that really make us feel the sense of what you were going through as a surgeon after you had made, I guess, a mentor surgeon almost mad with some perspiration dripping in your first account of performing neurosurgery. But I was struck by the fact that you used visualization essentially in that surgery. And a lot of people would say, I wouldn't want any surgeon to using visualization. I want to look straight on ahead. Huh?
Well, in that particular situation, there was no ability to look straight on ahead. This was a situation with a four-year-old child who, during the process of the resection, my assistant actually tore the major draining vein and the child was bleeding to death. And with all of our efforts, we still had no clarity about the anatomy. And I had to really stop, and I had really nothing else left. And I tried to visualize, and in fact did visualize, sort of how the anatomy was before all of that happened, and was able ultimately to put a clip on that vessel and save the child's life.
A clip in the right place.
The right place.
Which, you know, is an extraordinary story. And I wasn't trying to be flip about it, but many people would think, can visualization work on that kind of under those kind of circumstances? Should we therefore conclude that visualization is something that really ought to be brought into the operating room?
Well, I think successful people in general use visualization to achieve various goals, whether it's what we more traditionally think in the context of an athlete. Because what happens for many people in these professions that demand really clarity of intention, thought, one relives exactly what you're going to do under each potential circumstance. And some people talk about muscle memory, but in the context of this situation, it's really about remembering exactly how things were and how you want them to proceed, and having a real clear view of anatomy and where things are and how things are in three-dimensional space, which is really critical for success in the operating room.
And one might say you had obviously a good memory. You got through medical school and all the rest of that, so that probably served you too. I'm just wondering, I want to get to the magic shop, but I read Shakti Gawain back in the day, you know, who was sort of the empress of visualization books and all that. And Charles Garfield was someone years ago I interviewed who talked about weightlifting. And as you said, you know, it certainly is something that athletes use. But I remember thinking to myself, gee, if visualization really worked, I would have been a star basketball player, because as a kid, that's what I imagined myself being, like Steph Curry on the basketball court all the time. I wasn't tall enough, didn't have the gifts, so it became a metaphor for me. How much can you really rely upon or depend upon visualization?
Well, as an example, I mean, if you said you wanted to fly tomorrow like a bird, all your efforts in the world are probably not going to accomplish that. So it has to be in the context of
plausibility.
But that being said, a lot of us don't appreciate our true abilities. And it's really finding that understanding of what our potential is and then striving towards that versus having unrealistic expectations, which are going to, of course, lead to disappointment.
Let's go to the magic shop, though, because that's where this all begins as far as your odyssey. You're 12 years old, as I said, walking around with your stingray and go into this magic shop. And there's a woman there by the name of Ruth, and she kind of takes you under her wing and decides that you have potential. She wants to teach you some things. She wants to mentor you, basically.
Huh? Well, that's exactly right. And what happened was that I actually, the orange stingray you talk about, I had saved diligently my money from doing jobs over a period of time. And I was very proud of that bike. And I was riding my bike to an area I normally didn't go to and saw a magic shop, which is something I had an interest in, and just walked in. And lo and behold, there was this woman, and I describe her as an earth mother type. She had this long, wavy, flowing hair. And she had this incredibly radiant smile. And, of course, I was interested in the magic in the store. And what she told me was that her son owned the store, and he was a magician, and she knew nothing about magic. But the interesting thing about this woman and sort of my particular situation as a 12-year-old was that because, frankly, I had no future, I was already becoming a delinquent, had some issues with anger and resentment and a feeling that, you know, what was wrong with my life? Why was I put into this situation? And this woman really, in a very, very kind way, just asked me a few questions and actually some really penetrating as far as my background. And after about 20 or 30 minutes, she said to me, she said, you know, I really like you. She said, if you come in every day for the next 6 weeks, and that's how long she was going to be there, she would teach me something that could change my life. And, you know, I wish I could tell you I had some incredible insight and self-awareness what this meant. Frankly, she had given me some cookies. She was a nice lady. I had nothing else to do. So I showed up.
And learned a great deal from her. Learned particularly, well, the importance of listening to your heart, which comes later in your story, because maybe you would put too much emphasis on this cerebral part of things or the brain part of things, but also taught you almost a kind of rudimentary sense of meditation and of focus and of also dispensing with the negativity that can be so toxic.
No, that's exactly right. At the point that I walked into this magic shop, I tell people I felt like a leaf being blown by an ill wind. I had absolutely no control. Events would change. And I always was in the state of anxiety and fear because I never knew what was going to happen next. And what I tell people is when I walked into that magic shop, really, I had a perception that I had limited to any possibilities for what most of us would describe as a successful future.
So she taught you, perhaps above all, about self-help, about, well, relaxing your body, clarifying your intentions, focusing, doing things that can really bring you to a higher level of accomplishment and a higher level of succeeding.
Well, imagine this is in 1968 and those types of terms and this idea of Eastern philosophy and, if you want to use the term mindfulness, really they were not on anybody's radar screen and they were not even talked about. And frankly, I don't know her background or her history, but clearly she had some experience with this and saw probably within her own experience how powerful it was for her and decided to share it with me. And that fundamental interaction with her over that 6-week period of time changed the trajectory of my life from this perception that I had no or limited possibilities to one of unlimited possibilities. And I tell people, really, this was my first experience with this concept of neuroplasticity.
Which we'll get to. I want to get to with you. It's an important part of your work, an important part of the work you do, particularly on compassion and empathy. I want to find out more about Ruth, though. But the real lesson that comes across in many ways from her is you said there wasn't nobody was mindful of mindfulness, so nobody even knew what it was. But we were mindful at that time of kind of Norman Vincent Peale philosophy. That is the idea that positive thinking is a good thing. I'm wondering if she maybe brought you into that umbrella or under that umbrella.
No, I think that's right. I tell people it was sort of this combination of meditation practice or mindfulness intertwined with the power of positive thinking, Dale Carnegie, yeah. Norman Vincent Peale, and this visualization techniques and sort of, if you will, created a program that I needed and that allowed me to ultimately reach my own potential.
So other than her cookies and the fact that she was a nice lady, I mean, what drew you to her? And why did you keep going back? A lot of kids would have said, I want to spend my time with this lady, listening to her essentially be a kind of teacher to me or whatever.
Well, you have to understand, first of all, if you grow up in a situation as I described and you're not intelligent and you're not self-aware, you would normally just accept your circumstance that it is what it is and that's your life. If you are self-aware and you're intelligent, it actually is quite painful because you're looking around and you're questioning, why does this person who seemingly is not any different than me, why were they born into this circumstance? Why are they able to do this? Why is it that they have this opportunity? And what's so typical is that, especially for a child, is you put into your mind that the reason that they're in that position and you're in your position is because somehow you have a defect, there's something about you, it's your own fault. And I think that's very hard. And then what happens is that oftentimes with people in these types of situations, they start getting labeled. And once you're labeled, oftentimes you live up to that labeling. As an example, even in high school, you know, the guidance counselor didn't talk to me about becoming a doctor or going to college because I grew up in poverty and he had judged me as not capable or not having that opportunity. And this is really the sad thing. So already I was filling my head with voices or dialogue which was limiting my capabilities and judging me. And this was really the gift she gave me, not only the ability to have attention and focus, but to understand that the dialogue that goes on in many of our heads, and this is very common in the West, this sort of negative self-talk, isn't you. It's actually something that has been created and that unfortunately so many of us respond to, not only sort of how we live our lives or limit our lives, but also have a physiologic effect, which can be very, very negative.
And because you think it's you, I mean, as opposed to it's not necessarily being you, it's the messages that you almost by osmosis absorb.
Exactly. And what I describe in the book is that it's like a DJ. You know, you've turned to a channel and he keeps playing this negative music or this negative program, and you're sitting there all day long listening to it. And really the gift she gave me was to understand
you can change the channel.
That you could change the channel, and ultimately you could turn the volume down or change a channel to one which is more self-affirming. And when you start having that, you no longer have that negative physiologic response, but you also have a greater sense of compassion for yourself and a view that you can have goals and reach those goals.
Talking to James Doty, who is clinical professor in neurosurgery at Stanford School of Medicine, also author of Into the Magic Shop, A Neurosurgeon's Quest to Discover the Mysteries of the Brain and the Secrets of the Heart. And this gets us right into this idea of rewiring the brain, which admittedly on the face of it semantically sounds a little scary when you talk about it. But neuroplasticity, I mean, we learned and have learned in just the last decade so much about neuroscience. You can actually not only change, you know, from your self-denigration, self-laceration, all this sort of self-abasement that people experience, but you can make yourself, perhaps even more importantly, more compassionate, kinder, not only to yourself but to others.
Well, the interesting thing is that what many people don't appreciate, especially in this modern world where many people are stressed, is that really our default mode as a species is to care and nurture. But when you start having this self-dialogue that it's negative, it limits yourself in your ability not only to care for yourself but also to give that to other people. But the extraordinary thing is that we know from a variety of studies at this point in time that when one cares and is compassionate and is of service to others, it has a profound effect on their physiology in that their cardiac function improves, their blood pressure lowers, their immune system is boosted, their levels of stress hormones are lowered. And it's the stress hormones, which are oftentimes chronically released in people who are stressed, if you will, that have very, very deleterious effects on the body. And so it's this combination of physiologic responses that when you nurture others, when you care for others, you're at this place where you feel actually quite good. Your body functions at its best. And this area of your brain called your executive control function, which is in your frontal area, actually works its best and allows you to be more focused, to be more productive, and to be more creative.
So it gets us back maybe to visualization in a way, because I remember Bernie Siegel from Yale and a lot of, you know, like you, very lettered physicians and well-trained and so forth, who said, if you take care of other people, you're kind and more selfless, you know, it'll not only help boost your immune system and make you physiologically. But if you use visualization, let's say you have a tumor, you should use visualization, or you've got a malignancy, to try to essentially get rid of that. And there was a sense that somehow there was a tie there. But if things are metastasizing, I don't know how much – again, it gets back to the reality behind visualizing and people taking it to extremes.
Right. I mean, we do have a capacity to heal ourselves. We do have a capacity, if you will, to rewire our brains, but it does have limitations. Of course, you're familiar with the placebo effect. Why is it that when we use a variety of drugs and compare them to ones that are simply sugar pills in populations that up to 3/4 of the people have the identical response to the pill? It's because our belief in the effectiveness of this, or our belief in our physiology changing, allows it to change. And this is just an extension of this concept of visualization. And we have seen that in as an example, in certain types of tumor cases, that when an individual has this type of clarity of purpose, this intention, it can actually change the blood flow in different parts of the brain or to a tumor area, or it can increase the metabolism. And certain types of mind-trained practitioners, let's say monks who spend hours and hours training their minds, you could actually ask them to, as an example, Matthieu Ricard, who you may be familiar with, who's a Buddhist monk, who's called the happiest man on earth. You can put him under an MRI, look at the metabolism of certain parts of his brain, and he can actually control it to the point where you can say, show me 50% empathy, and the metabolism will increase to that level. Or you can say, decrease your empathic response, and his level of blood flow to that area of the brain associated with empathic response can decrease. So it's really quite extraordinary what we have in terms of our ability to control our own physiology.
It reminds me of those Tibetan monks who would sit on the mountain and they'd be all chilled, and then they'd put on, take off their robe, and they just warm their body up through kind of automatic executive control, as you indicated earlier. Which reminds me, you formed kind of a friendship with the Dalai Lama. How'd you meet him?
Well, it's sort of interesting. I had, based on my own background, had always had this interest in what is it that makes somebody reach out and care. As an example of what Ruth did for me, really selflessly, because she got no reward for this, what are the motivators that make people care? And because I also, after studying this area, realized that it really does positively affect you. So I had begun these research studies, and I was walking through the Stanford campus. And I have to be frank with you, I had no particular connection to the Dalai Lama, but it popped into my head, it wouldn't be wonderful if he came to Stanford and talked with the scientists I was working with about compassion. And I, to this day, cannot tell you why that thought came into my head, because I'm not a Buddhist and I did not follow the Dalai Lama. But needless to say, he had visited Stanford previously in 2005. And I tracked down the person who had invited him. And to make a long story short, this led to a meeting. And what's extraordinary about that meeting is that I explained to him the work that I had begun in the context of research. And if you don't know the Dalai Lama, he's very interested in neuroscience. He's been working with neuroscientists for over 30 years, exploring how meditation affects the brain and more recently how compassion affects the brain.
So he's been working on emotional intelligence with people like Daniel Goleman.
Exactly. Yeah. And what happened is that he and I began this wonderful dialogue and that extended far beyond what had been scheduled. And he immediately agreed to come to Stanford. But what's interesting is, as our conversation wound down, and of course, you know, he speaks English quite well, but he always has a translator with him. And this translator, Thupten Jinpa, and he began this animated conversation in Tibetan. And I was quite anxious that somehow I had done a faux pas and irritated the Dalai Lama, which, of course, no one wants to irritate the Dalai Lama. And at the end of their conversation, Jinpa turned to me and he said, "Jim, His Holiness is so moved by this program that you have begun that he wants to make a personal donation." And that donation that he made ended up being the largest donation he had ever made to a non-Tibetan cause at that time, which, again, was quite extraordinary and really overwhelming and gave me an immense sense of responsibility to him.
And there is, in fact, a plug from the Dalai Lama on your book, also from Thich Nhat Hanh and Abraham Verghese. We were speaking about placebos earlier, and he's done some wonderful work, also Stanford medical professor Deepak Chopra. And Glenn Beck, there's the riddle that I have to ask you about in terms of the plugs that you have. We'll come back and talk more with our guest, James Doty. And let me invite those of you who are with us and listening to us to join the program. How do you nurture compassion and get more compassion out of you? That's really what I want to get into with our guest and you, our listeners. Do you think compassion can be taught? Do you think, in fact, you can teach yourself to be more compassionate? And what's the value of it? Let me invite you to join us. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is James Doty. He's clinical professor in neurosurgery at Stanford School of Medicine, also the author of Into the Magic Shop, a neurosurgeon's quest to discover the mysteries of the brain and secrets of the heart. And I am going to ask him about Glenn Beck. But before I do, let's talk about the heart, because there's so much of your work that goes into bringing the heart into play and in your own story that goes ultimately to the heart, to the center of the heart. And when I think about opening one's heart and being responsive to, well, all these good things that we think about, all these virtues, goodness and empathy and compassion and kindness, then the skeptical voice in me, maybe not such a toxic voice, maybe a good voice in many ways, says, you know, the road to hell is paved with kindness and good intentions and so forth. But I also think about something one of my literary idols, William Faulkner, said when he gave a Nobel speech accepting the Nobel Prize. He said, "Great art comes from the heart against itself." And I thought, many respects, that is often the human condition. The heart can be divided. It can be against itself. And when you're opening your heart and you're simultaneously feeling let's say, ambivalence, which, you know, as Freud said, maybe is the most common emotion of the 20th century. What do you do to separate? That is, you know, the feelings when they're going against each other and they're in kind of collision.
Well, in some ways, it is the human condition, and the reality is it's the nature of our wiring. There is both a literal connection between the mind and the heart, and, of course, this figurative or literary connection. And it has been expressed over hundreds, if not thousands, of years in a variety of contexts. So from an anatomy point of view, what people oftentimes don't appreciate is that we have immense amount of nerves that extend from the brain and the brainstem into the heart and various other organs, and it's a two-way street. And that oftentimes this idea of connecting to your heart, when you do that and you actually send these impulses out, it is a change because we have this vagus nerve. And it modulates between what we call our sympathetic nervous system and our parasympathetic nervous system. And from our evolution as a species, remembering that our DNA has not changed over the last 200,000 years, as a species, we look around for potential threat. And it's even more complicated in modern society and, in fact, is a cause of a lot of stress and anxiety in people. And when that sympathetic nervous system is engaged, you have fear, anxiety, you want to withdraw, you don't want to connect, you shut down, and you're ready to have a response to this threat, which is commonly referred to as this flight or fight or fear response. And during that response, you have this immense release of stress hormones, cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, which allows you to escape threat. And in the context of being on the savannah in Africa, it's wonderful. You either live or you die, and if you die, it doesn't matter. If you live, your hormones go back down to this baseline level. But remember, at that time, if there was no threat, what happened is your baseline was really on the parasympathetic side, and this is what we call our relax and connect mode. And when you're in that state, which is, again, I tell you, is our default mode as a species, it allows you to connect. You have a sense of calmness. You have a desire to have affiliative behavior. Your blood pressure is lowered. Your immune system is boosted. And these deleterious hormones associated with the threat response are at their baseline. And when you're at that level, that is when you, again, function at your best. So there's always this constant communication between your heart and your mind. And it is, in fact, a two-way street. And in fact, there's a syndrome in Japan where it was first described in Japan called the broken heart syndrome, where somebody has this immense response to loss of a loved one or a breakup, and their heart just stops. And so we know that there is this connection, and we're finding more and more about how really profound this is, and more importantly, how we can take control of this response. In fact, I give a lecture called Hacking Your Brain for Happiness.
Well, I'm thinking, interestingly enough, of times when, like, somebody cuts me off in traffic and suddenly I'm aroused in a way that I want to almost go after the person. I might be speaking with my blood and wanting to respond to that impulse, but I don't. I intercede. I think I intercede with my brain, though, because it feels like my blood wants to do something that's almost primitive.
No. In fact, that's exactly right. It's you suddenly shift into this threat mode, and you feel aggressive. But let me give you an interesting example about this, because most of us have this immediate reaction when that something like that happens, and oftentimes it's characterized by an expletive or a hand gesture.
A number of expletives.
But. You know, what I tell people is, and what we train people to do and what you can train yourself to do, is instead of having that type of responses, which is an immediate reaction, let's change it, that dynamic. And let's say if I said to you, the person who just cut you off, they were not rushing to work. They were not just doing that on purpose to take advantage of their situation. But let's say it was a husband whose wife is sitting next to him. She's 9 months pregnant. Her water's broken. She's bleeding. And he's rushing, you know, to
you imagine something compassionate that makes you feel for that person.
Because, you know, the other thing.
The person may just be a rotten person, though, too, of course.
Well, of course, that's possible. But you see, this gets to another point is look at the story you're creating for yourself. Yes, potentially they are a rotten person. This brings up something else because oftentimes people behave towards you in a manner which has nothing to do with you. It has to do – it could be what they ate that morning. It could be they were had an argument with their spouse. It could be they had some sort of financial emotional setback. And the interaction they're having with you is actually quite negative. And of course, the tendency, just like in that example we just gave of driving, you have a tendency to have an immediate emotional response. But the response is your choice. And if you don't have that reactive response to them, you don't engage in the manner in which they're engaging with you, suddenly they have no place to go with it. And oftentimes it brings them back to reality, calms the situation down. And as long as you're open, you're not in this defensive posture, you're not having these facial expressions that basically people are able to read as an aggressive response back to them, this actually is very, very calming to people and actually puts them in a mode to relax themselves. And it can be very effective.
But lots of people who want to talk with you. Just quickly, though, I was joking a little bit about Glenn Beck, but you found even though he lives in sort of a parallel universe from you or from me, from many of us here in the Bay Area, there was something about going in and trying to be compassionate and open to someone who has very different, obviously, political views than you do and who is in this other universe from you.
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, it's easy to converse with people who look like you, act like you, think like you, or in the same culture, religion, socioeconomic class, and it makes you feel comfortable. Again, this is our natural response, and this is sort of this idea of tribalism. The challenge, though, is how do you connect with people who are different from you, and how do you try to understand them? It is not by forcing your ideas on them. And it's interesting that I was introduced to Glenn, and he does have a different worldview. But the amazing thing is that, look, he has 5.4 million viewers who follow him. 5.4 million viewers are not terrorists. They're not stupid. They're not angry and hostile. So I have to accept the fact that I have to look into myself to see what is about those people that are attracted to the message he has. And he has a message to them now that oftentimes can be extreme, but really the core of his message, if you separate out of these extremities, is really what most of us want, which is we want to feel that we're safe. We want to feel that we're not being taken advantage of. We want to feel that we're with people who sort of agree with us. And my experience has been, and I think this is the case with Glenn, is number one, you cannot forcibly change people's minds. The only way you can change people's minds is to develop a relationship, to have a respect, recognize their dignity, and have mutual trust. When that happens, it allows you to communicate. Now, you may not all ultimately agree, but it means you can live together, survive, have respect, and go forward. And that's really the word about compromise in life.
And if you just joined us, I brought up Glenn Beck because there's a nice plug on Jim's book from Glenn Beck. And let me go to our callers, and let's go first to you, Kim. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. About 6 months ago, I was diagnosed as having early onset Alzheimer's. And I'm having a little – I want to go into this with as much grace and dignity as I possibly can. However, there's a couple of things that happen. It's sort of like a slow-motion train crash because you just begin by forgetting things that you used to remember, like directions to a place you always went to. But the worst problem for me has been informing others of why I'm forgetful and what happens to you and their estimation of you. I'm finding that doctors sometimes, once this diagnosis is made, they're a little bit dismissive. They are sort of like, it is what it is, and not a whole lot at this point that we can do. I'm trying to go into it calmly, and I'm trying to accept this for what it is. It's not the worst thing that can happen, but it's inflaming me. I'm not dealing with this right, and I'd like to know if you can offer me any kind of suggestions.
Well, you know, unfortunately, oftentimes the events that we live with, what happens and how we feel about them is ultimately based on our choice. And while I appreciate you feel inflamed, the reality is that, and I'm not trying to minimize what's happening to you, but it is what it is. But what you can do yourself is to accept this reality and try not to have an emotional response to it, because it's oftentimes not beneficial. Of course, this is a horrible tragedy. Of course, no one would want to go through what you're going through. But as you point out, it could be worse. As an example, in the nature of my profession, you know, I deal with people who have had trauma or events that occur that they're gone immediately. And the incredible blessing that, in fact, you have is that you have a period of time where you can connect, where you can resolve issues, where you can actually give love to people, forgive people, and embrace people. And it will be the most nourishing thing that you can do when you can let go of what often many of us carry with us, which are these sort of feelings about our life experiences and perhaps how others have not treated us the way we wish or how events did not play out. And when you look into yourself and realize you have this immense ability to embrace what's happened to you and to communicate and to share and make other people's lives easier who may be also in that situation, I think that's actually a gift that you really do have.
Sound advice, Kim, and good luck to you. Thank you for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. Sometimes when you feel inflamed, the argument will go, it's good to give into your emotions, to be authentic, to release them, be cathartic with them. You say what to that?
Well, I think that's wonderful. But there's a difference between holding that emotion, being with it, and having that response, which is sometimes wonderfully cathartic. But that's far different than picking up a gun and shooting the person who's irritated you.
No, I don't think that was what she was suggesting.
No. I'm not. Yeah. I'm looking at another example. But what I'm saying is that it is very difficult. But yes, and there's nothing wrong with screaming and yelling and crying and saying, this isn't fair. But you do have to get over that, because the situation's not going to change either.
And here's James joining us. James, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. I've been working with people with trauma and using mindfulness to address that. And I'm wondering what your research has to say on the role of reciprocity in the effects of mindfulness and compassionate thinking. In other words, if somebody doesn't know or appreciate that you're doing something for them, does that still have the same effect on the person? Or similarly, with African-American populations, sort of microaggressions that are frequently endured. You can use compassion if you want, but those microaggressions are very real.
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, what you perceive as a helpful action, someone may not. And in fact, there's a concept of pathological altruism where, you know, an individual may really believe that what he is engaging in is useful, and it's not perceived that way in any way. And I think in part you have to have self-awareness that that may be the case. And again, you can only do what you can do. And if you do have a perception it's not being perceived the right way, then respond to that accordingly. The other side of it is when you give and you care, the reality is it should not be in the context of I expect X, Y, or the, or even this response. Caring should not have any requirement that there be in a response. As an example, somebody going, boy, you're the greatest guy in the world. I love you. This is fantastic. You're so great. But it's hard, because that's what you do want, because you want this affirmation of what you've done. But that's not always possible. And I think the greatest thing you can do is understand this reality, do what you can. And if you get a wonderful response, that's fantastic. If you don't, that's okay too, because you know what you've done.
All this achievement that you've had success in the entrepreneurial field, and you've had certainly a great deal of recognition and what I would hesitate to call glory for, you know, all that you've achieved. But have to, and kept, you know, your humility, which is important. But when this feeling surfaced, when you're that 12-year-old boy again or something, and they do come back, I'm sure, right?
Oh, absolutely.
What do you do about them?
Well, yeah, because, you know, we're all damaged in different ways. We all have baggage that are manifestations of what we've experienced in our lives. And for many, they still give people pain. And the thing is not to act like these didn't happen or these didn't exist, but to be able to sit with them, acknowledge them, but not get lost in them.
And move on.
And move on. And that's really the critical thing. And also, if you – it's when you compare yourself to others who may have had more successful accomplishments in different arenas, then you're always sitting there with this sort of rumination about, geez, I wasn't good enough. But when you really look at it and look at yourself in a broader aspect and accept that none of us can achieve everything, that there are always going to be people who seemingly have done better than us, and just say that's okay too. I'm okay with who I am, and I don't need to be somebody different, and I like myself. And that's even with your failings, your flaws, your defects. And this is the thing about interacting with the Dalai Lama or people like him, because when you interact with them, they embrace you and you feel this unconditional love and this warmth. And it's that thing that we all desire. And when we allow ourselves to be who we are without carrying this pretension of what we want to present or what we want people to think we are, it is actually a release and allows you really to be who you are and also then to embrace others in the same way.
Let me read some comments. Pascal writes, to me, compassion is like breathing. It's part of me. Compassion is my way to help out humanity, our humanity heal from the terrible path it has engaged. And John writes, my aunt used the expression there, but for the grace of God go I. When I was a Christian, it was at the center of what I consider my relationship with others. And now that I'm an atheist, I still do. Here is Gerald who says, to what extent can having a better life increase, if not the capacity for charity, then its readiness of expression? I wonder because though the poor are capable of astonishing acts of charity, it also seems to be true that the hatred of the poor and the weak seems easily fermentable among the harried and worried poor. As the punchline of a Hasidic story has it, if he eats meat, he will know the poor need bread. If he eats only bread, he will think the poor can live on stones. Let me go to a question here from a listener who, Leah, who says, everything you've discussed so far resonates deeply with me. I find that I have a lot of compassion for fellow human beings, but finding and nurturing compassion for myself has been much more difficult. Why is that?
Actually, I think that is a dilemma we have in especially Western society. There is this notion that loving yourself, that being kind to yourself is somehow wrong. And people carry this sense that they're not good enough or that they're somehow an imposter. And Krista Neff, who's done an immense amount of work in this area, work that we do, is to show people how essentially, if you will, to love yourself. And it gets back to what I was talking about. There is not a single human being who does not have a dark side. There's not a single human being who has done bad things to other people, who has lied, who has failed in different areas, and who have not lived up to their own expectations. And that's okay. That is the human condition. It's recognizing this, not being too hard on yourself, and trying to really be the best person you can be.
You got to get rid of those voices in your head, you know, especially probably our background. I wasn't as poor as you were, but I was, you know, lower middle class, and my parents didn't have a lot of self-esteem. And a lot of that, you know, goes on to the next generation. It's hard to draw yourself away from it, and it's hard to, regardless of what you succeed in doing or achieve. Let me bring actually some more callers. I want to get Michael on next. Michael, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you very much. My question is, I'm a recovering heroin addict, 15 years clean, and my wife is a suffering alcoholic. And I find myself getting frustrated because what seemed to work for me to get clean and stay clean doesn't seem to work for her. So I was wondering if there's like, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like a neurological checklist that I can go through for myself to become more empathetic for her situation.
Well, you know, this is one of the challenges. You know, the worst person's the reformed reformer, right? Where, geez, I've overcome the challenge, And why shouldn't they be able to do it because I was able to do it? The reality, though, they are not you. And oftentimes we have a tendency to judge people based on our ability to overcome something. It's like many times people are very, very judgmental of the poor or drug addicts. And I also want to congratulate you on being clean for 15 years. When you put the pressure on somebody and they sense that you were always judging them and they have an addiction problem, what does that do? It creates the shame, the embarrassment of their condition. And that does not put them in the mental framework to succeed or overcome their addiction. And you probably had people who helped you who, regardless of how many times you failed, embraced you still, recognized you as a human being, supported you, and you came back again and they gave you love. And what I would suggest to you, the greatest gift you can give your wife is not to judge her and to say, listen, I know it's hard. I know you're struggling. I am here for you.
Okay. Let me thank the caller for that. I want to get another caller on here, and that's Susan. Susan, join us.
Hi. Thank you so much for this show. I'm delighted with it. And one part of your story stuck out for me, which was that you had both of these kinds of knowing, that the highly educated, trained aspect of being a neurosurgeon, and then that heart-centered instinct level. And as we talked about judging people, I do a lot of work in community engagement with people with below-average education, working poor, who are labeled and judged because they don't have the highly trained ways of knowing, and then they discount their other ways of knowing. And I'm just curious if in part of your work or your how could we, just another listener said, instead of judging the poor and saying, oh, well, they're too busy or too deficient to give, are we demeaning them by not acknowledging they probably have a lot to give?
Well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, imagine if you have to spend 4 to 6 hours a day finding food, how is it that you can somehow think about all these abstract things and do all these other things? I mean, people are often discounted because they are poor. But I will tell you, some of the wisest, most intelligent people I have ever met in my life, people would oftentimes overlook. And I will tell you, in my own situation, I was in college, but I have a very difficult time because I had to leave frequently. And as a result, my grade point average was actually quite low. And when I went to get a letter of recommendation for medical school from our pre-med committee at my college, here is what I was told. It is a waste of everyone's time for us to give you an appointment for that letter because you will never go to medical school. Who has the right to make those types of decisions for an individual? And this is the incredible thing, is that when you recognize a person's dignity, when you give them respect, what it does is it allows them to blossom and really be who they are, because so many people shut down when people judge them. But like I said, I've had some of the most engaging, incredible conversation and have learned so much from people who have been overlooked and disregarded.
There is the assumption that if you don't have, a straight-A average now, you can't get into medical school or veterinary school. It just seems to be absolutely understood. There's no way.
Well, I think, unfortunately, you're correct. Now, there recently was an admission by Harvard that said they're now going to count, quote-unquote, kindness into their decision-making process. What's ridiculous is that all of these criteria that you describe that limit people from getting into these institutions are arbitrary, artificial, and multiple studies have shown they have absolutely no relationship to ultimate success in that profession or in life. All you need is, generally speaking, an above-average level of intelligence, which frankly most people have, and passion and intention. And I will also tell you that some of the worst doctors I have ever met in my entire life are straight-A students.
Let me go to a couple of comments and then a question to end here. Christina writes, Lose your eyes and focus on your heart and feel the gratitude of all you have. It opens my heart and makes me more compassionate toward others and joyful. My day flows with synchronicity and joy. And Pete says, compassion begins with insight into self and self-compassion. Then one realizes it's for everyone, not just you. We're all together in this. And a question from Deb, can you address the possibility of encouraging mutual compassion between or among warring factions? Example, cops and inner city citizens, right-left politicians.
Well, I think the problem is polarization, which results in lack of communication, results in inability to do anything. The reality is to function in life requires compromise, it requires respect, and it requires communication. And without that, nothing is possible. And there have been repeated instances, whether it's in Israel and the Gaza, between factions who have far different opinions, who have come together and shared their humanity, or individual police officers who have been able to go into a community and be accepted and, in fact, cherished. And it all relates to them being non-judgmental, being accepting, and showing compassion, caring, and recognizing the dignity and humanity of the other person.
That's assuring to hear you speak. Now I don't have to have the prefrontal lobotomy to change my self-degradation.
Well, let's not get carried away. You may still need that.
James Doty, our guest. Thank you for joining us. Pleasure to have you. And Jim Doty is clinical professor in neurosurgery at Stanford School of Medicine, author of Into the Magic Shop, a neurosurgeon's quest to discover the mysteries of the brain and secrets of the heart. And you can continue this discussion online. We invite you to do that, kqed.org/forum. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Greatly appreciate your listenership and the fact that you participate in the program, those of you who called, emailed, and texted us. And I want to also remind you who's behind the scenes here, because that's very important to realize. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you for listening. Once again, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.